Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. By the way, if anybody doesn't know what podcasting is or has any questions about that, you can just write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or ask your local technically inclined person, and they will tell you. I'd like now to welcome, well, first of all, later on in the program, Dr. Betty Korber will be here talking about the obstacles in the way to making a vaccine against AIDS and HIV. Right now, I would like to welcome Nicolas Guagnini. He is an Argentine artist whose work is in Los Desaparecidos, The Disappeared, which is at Site Santa Fe. The exhibition there, and also the series of events, including exhibitions, films, lectures, workshops, that are taking place all over the city, all over for the next 3 months. And Juliette Myers is here from Site Santa Fe. She's the Director of Education and Public Programs. Welcome.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Wonderful to have you here. You were born and raised in Argentina, and for those who have not yet become cognizant of Los Desaparecidos, The Disappeared, this is a program about this horrifying phenomenon that took place over decades in Latin America in the late 20th century, and you are as close to it as anybody, and you'll tell your story in a moment, but you were born and raised in Argentina. What was your life like before the military coup?
I would say it was a comfortable life, upper middle class, extreme cultural privilege in the sense that my family was part of intelligentsia. My grandmother was an art dealer, my grandfather was an art collector, my father was a journalist. So I lived among mostly artists and intellectuals. Within the context of the 60s in South America, Argentina was a fairly equitable and utopic society. Say 40% of the population was middle class. Education was and is still free and fairly high quality. So I was living an interesting life.
And then what do you remember about the military coup in 1976 when it happened?
Well, pretty much everything. I was 10 years old, and the escalation in violence that led to the coup had started a few years ago. And also I was living in the Nueve de Julio Avenue, which is, equals what would be Fifth Avenue in New York or something like that. But it's the street where all demonstrations will take place that leads to the government house and so on and so forth. So literally history will parade in front of my house. I will see the tanks rolling in, literally. So there's nothing not to remember. And in general terms, the disintegration of the social tissue and of my family and my family life, that's something very vivid. At 10, I even kept, I was writing then, I kept a diary, I was already drawing and doing my thing, so I have a very, very knitted memory of that time.
Did your family feel right away that it was in danger?
Yes, absolutely.
Father was a journalist.
My father was a journalist. He corresponded, I think, for the Washington Post in the U.S. He was an political opinion journalist. He would write op-eds, fundamentally.
And so, right away, he said what he thought?
From 1974 on, there was a paramilitary group called the AAA that had a list of people to be assassinated. And my father was very early on that list, among a set of prominent journalists. And no, none of them would shut up.
So this was before the coup, but it was the people who
right.
were involved in creating the coup.
Right.
And so your father was then disappeared on December 12, 1977.
Correct, 76. 77. You're right, sorry.
And did your family immediately know what happened?
Yes. Yes.
And so what did you do next? How did you, your family, your group respond?
Well, we were not in immediate danger because the target was my father. So leaving the country would not change things. My grandmother was a founding of one of the human rights organizations, Familiares of the Desaparecidos, which means relatives of the disappeared. And the thing that we did do is we launched an international press campaign. We basically called every newspaper where my father had worked for or had a contact or that knew him, and all of those newspapers published news or put pressure and so on and so forth, which basically kind of kept him alive for a year. That we learned later.
Did you? How were you able to find out anything about his whereabouts?
We were not able to find anything about his whereabouts. What happened is that the military were trained people who understood who were valuable targets, and a set of highly prepared individuals were separated and put in another kind of concentration camp to collaborate. One of them, who was a physician that helped the government set up the color television to be able to broadcast the World Cup that was upcoming, the country did not have color television and they were on a deadline, was in that group. So much later, when the dictatorship ended, this person furnished testimony against the military and told everything that was happening. And basically, the people that were in that separate group were still subject to torture and this and that, but they were asked to collaborate. My father was asked to interpret the news from different standpoints, i.e. a Marxist standpoint, a liberal standpoint, and report in writing back to the military so they would understand how to read the news. So he was doing intellectual labor. Then they step it up and they wanted him to do something that was a fairly common practice and that ended up with the death of many people, that he would go around to public places under kind of discreet surveillance, and whoever will come up to talk to him will be marked and taken away. So he will be acting as a decoy to disappear more people. He wouldn't do
Good
that.
Heavens.
He wouldn't do that.
He wouldn't do that.
He wouldn't do that. And that's, you know, when we know he was killed.
Because he would not collaborate in that way.
Right. That was, I think, beyond him.
We're talking to artist Nicholas Guagnini. What is it like for you to talk about this in public all these years later? Is this something you've been doing all along for the last 30 years?
I could not become a human rights militant. I didn't have the emotional ability to do it. I think that's one of the reasons why I went into art, but I became an artist. I could not see the trauma every day and be with the people with the trauma every day. So I foolishly thought that by putting all of it in an artwork, I'll let it out and it'll be out there for the world to see. What happened was just the opposite. This extraordinary curator from North Dakota, Laura Rader, put up this exhibition, which is booked for 4 years to come and has been in many, many venues in South America and in the United States. And I end up pretty much every 3 months in a situation like this, talking in public or in a lecture or in the press and revisiting the history of my life. It's also strange, you know, like every other immigrant, I came to the United States to an extent to reinvent myself or to start from scratch. And I don't mean only in the sense of opportunity or emotionally, to rebuild myself. So what happens is that my life has become a public matter. You know, I have a career, a position, and this and this and that, and all the people around me are coming back to me and said, oh, I didn't know you were coming from such trauma and this and that. So I would say, particularly with the presentation of the show in New York, where it attracted an enormous amount of press and the New York Times, it's a degree of exposure that simultaneously heals and gives me closure on the one hand, and then on the other hand, revives all that stuff again and again.
Right, right. The in the years when you became, when you moved to New York, you became an artist. Were you dealing with this material as the subject of your artwork?
I came to New York about 10 years ago when I was 30. I could not do art in relationship to this back in Argentina. I think the same block that prevented me from becoming a militant, prevented that trauma to emerge inside the work. You know, when you're an artist, people fantasize that you sit down in a studio and have a stroke of inspiration and stuff happens. You are an instrument of the art itself. You know, you let things come through you. You don't make things happen. You're there as a kind of transmission device of personal and collective emotions that then you're trying to make become artwork. But and no artist has full control. That's a fantasy
right.
that the audience has and many of us foster as well. So what happened is I think that by being at a distance, I was able to put it kind of all in a piece. That took me a while. It took me a year to come up with the model of a piece.
After moving to
Yes. Yeah, I moved to New York. I was a year or maybe a little more, you know, finding a studio, getting a green card, adaptation, this and that. You know, setting my life up.
Right.
And then maybe another year to develop the work.
Now, this. When did you do this piece? That, we'll talk about this piece in a second. It's in front of Site Santa Fe. It's the first thing you see when you're walking by or even driving by. When did you make the piece?
But before I go in depth into the piece, I have to say, and I'm very, very pleased with the installation here in Site Santa Fe. The physical conditions for the audience and for the public could not be better. There are railroad tracks and a stop sign, so the speed at which cars drive by makes the exact possibility for an appreciation of the piece, and I think the people here did an extraordinary job. From all the venues in which my piece has been installed, this is by, you know, this is at the best, I think. I'm very, very, very pleased. But now I'll go into the piece.
Yeah, describe the piece for our
audience.
The
piece consists in 25 vertical square section kind of sticks that form a cube. This is about 12 feet by 12 feet by 12 feet. And as you walk around it or drive around it, you see that it has black spots and they begin to configure as a face. There is a particular angle when you see it from a corner in which all these sticks conform like a plane, like a pictorial plane, in which the image kind of configures. You reconstruct the face, and as you walk or drive towards one side or the other side, the face literally decomposes and disappears. So the very...
And it's the face of your father.
It's the face of my father, and it's made in high contrast, black and white, and more importantly, it was the picture that my grandmother used for the demonstrations. And to an extent, something that I think the piece does successfully and that I'm kind of proud of, the sensation of a face, somebody carrying a face on the street or a face moving in the street, the urgency of a demonstration, the reminder that we're looking for this person, where is this person, but that this is active on the street, and it as well has to activate the spectator. You as a spectator cannot be passive. This is not a museum contemplation situation in which you're standing in front of a painting feeling how sublime it is. You ought to do something. You ought to walk around it to understand it. I think it disconnects to the street. When I say activation of the spectator, the words I want to connote are also activism. So, whilst I could only possibly do a piece about my father, I called the piece 30,000, which is the number of people disappeared in Argentina, because I intended to be an homage not only to these 30,000 people, but to the relatives and militants that have kept a struggle and a memory alive for 30-something years. It is to be noted that finally the people that committed those crimes are being brought into court. Now, as we speak, every day there's somebody else going into court and so on and so forth. I consider that this struggle is finding its closure and has been successful in the long run, that this society will finally pay its due in the legal sense. You know, that somebody who committed a crime ought to be punished for that horrible crime, and that society cannot pay back by killing or torturing that person. That society needs to, even if that these people are horrible criminals, they have a right to due process, go to court, and to jail, where they belong. But that bespeaks of a society that is beginning 30 years after, to move past that horrendous set of events.
Why do you think it's taken so long?
The political power of the military didn't wane away until 10 years later. There is a large civilian complicity. Civil society kept on working through the military period, and everybody was entangled at one point or another economically. So these people, I mean, the society couldn't face that itself. Then the application of the neoliberal economical policies during the 90s implied a direct alignment with the United States. And it has to be noted that the dictatorships were financially and ideologically backed by the United States. This was seen as South America was seen as a pawn in the general struggle of the Cold War. It was Kissinger who implemented torture there. I mean, these people were trained oftentimes by the CIA. So during the 90s, the neoliberal governments were strictly aligned with Washington. Now is a moment of increased anti-Americanism and increased detachment in every sense, and also economically. The Argentina is a agricultural powerhouse, and mainly we sell to China and to the European Union. So whether the Americans buy or don't buy our products doesn't really make a difference. That speaks of a degree of independence in the different sectors in the society and the most powerful sectors in the society that enable that society to be self-critical. These are economic and political facts that will give you a context. I think the other thing that has happened is that my generation, the generation of the children of the disappeared, is in power now. Have become judges, politicians, you know, people in society,
right?
And want to right that wrong.
Do you think at this point that something like that could happen in Argentina again, or has the awareness of the disappeared situation permeated society enough to prevent it?
You know, making historical predictions is a risky judgment.
Right.
You read Marx, and the economical theory is beautiful. And the theory itself, as philosophy, is sound. All his predictions about the revolution were damn wrong. So I believe the society has realized that it has a very high cost to pay. And I think the bottom line is that these are Argentines killing other Argentines. So no ideology could grant that. That lesson seems to have been learned. Then, you know, South America is a peaceful region on Earth. It's nowhere like Europe or the Middle East, where there has been, or Africa, where there has been constant war over the past two centuries, if you look at it closely. The question ever since the conquest is equality there, but not war. So I don't foresee any social struggle taking that tremendous toll. Then the other thing that happened is that the military has been fairly dismantled. They don't have any money, they don't have any control over the population, and so on and so forth. You know, the main asset of Argentine society, I think, is education. It's a highly educated society where this has become curriculum in elementary school. People learn about it. If anything, I anticipate something, you know, when you go to Germany and they talk about the Holocaust and they're overconscious of it and they talk and talk and talk about it. Whilst, for instance, other aspects in Germany, the repressive state apparatus of East Germany is entirely neglected. Very few people talk about the Stasi.
It's coming.
It's beginning to emerge right now.
With that film.
With that very good film. This is not repressed in Argentine society. It's ever present. I think that will prevent it, you know, from happening again.
We're talking to artist Nicolas Guagnini, and he will be speaking, by the way, tonight at 6 o'clock in a lecture at Site Santa Fe.
Yes, tickets are available.
Tickets are available.
Absolutely.
Juliet Myers piping in.
Piping in, saying that anyone who'd like to attend the lecture, you can call 989-1199 and reserve a ticket, or just come on down at about 5:30. The exhibition will be open and you can view the show before the lecture.
Extraordinary, extraordinary exhibition. Mm-hmm. Here you are taking part in this exhibition, Nicolas, with artists from Chile and Venezuela and Uruguay and all these other places. What is it like for you to have met these artists and come in contact with with the work from other countries on similar subjects to your own?
This is something that over the past 10 years has puzzled me, which is that New York is kind of a center of Latin America. If you are in Argentina or in Chile, you're always involved in the local problematics, and the discourse is around local art, or at best the relationship between local art and centers. Everything kind of comes together in New York. Some of the artists I knew, some I didn't know. What does strike me about the exhibition, and I think it's another merit of this extraordinary woman, Laura Reuter, the curator, is that in front of the same problem, which is to represent that that is horrendous, that cannot be represented, that has been lost, the solutions that many artists from many different places have found are strikingly similar. It's a very consistent exhibition.
Yeah.
In the end of the day, it's a photo exhibition.
Right.
Almost all the pieces, with the exception of two, are photo-based. Those photographic images have been altered in some way or form, so they're not presented as documents as such, but as something transformed. There is, in many pieces, something with time, something that appears or disappears, or you need to walk through it and take your time through it. There is something about interpolating the spectator, you know, a mirror next to the photograph to disappear. Who are you? Who is that person? And there is something about urban space and the larger space of society outside the specific realm or the cultural sphere as epitomized in a museum or in a cultural institution. There is this artist, Fernando Traversa, that did a workshop and stuff that happens in the street with the bicycles. It's art. There is an intervention by local artists right now in the exterior walls of the museum that relates to the exhibition. It's art that, to a large extent, calls for action, for the occupation of the public space, for the usage of the public sphere, that either does that or calls for that.
We were very thrilled with the sniping on the big wall that is along the railroad tracks at Site Santa Fe and Warehouse 21, and Stephen Osher, with a group of young people, have put images that relate to the Oscar Munoz images. But on top of that, Mary Charlotte, I don't know if you knew that we had some commentary to come as graffiti on top of the sniping.
Well, I was wondering if that was a planned part of the whole thing.
Do you know, not on our part. Let's just put it that way.
Really?
No, but we're...
My friend and I had looked at it and discussed it, and whether or not this was part, and we concluded that it was part
of
the exhibition.
Well, because, and I can understand, it's a very specific image that's very well done. In other words, we have stenciled, like, silkscreened images that were put up originally by the Warehouse 21 crew. And then we have... Oh, in one of the blanks, and this is something I need to say, that all of those images, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds going down the wall, of the exterior of the building. Within the context of those images, there were many blank pieces of paper that were put up with no image at all, which I think speaks in an interesting way of how the young people thought about this. So there are some blank images, yes. But when they came and Popeye appeared on the wall, it was done in the same vein with a wonderful stencil. So it's an interesting piece of graffiti that relates quite well and does open a conversation.
We've got just a minute or two left. Nicolas Guagnini, how do you feel at this point in your life about that sort of dialectic between keeping the memory of the disappeared, of your father, of the whole political situation alive versus moving on, putting it to rest, going forward?
You know, the term memory art, it works differently in different contexts. In all Latin American societies, and in particular in Argentina, this is open. The judicial processes are going on. People are testifying. So this is an open process. This is not something. This is something that is happening right now. Not something that has happened and we need to close. So I think that process will take another 4 or 5 years to close. In personal terms, I think that having done this piece and having done this, which has circulated in this exhibition and will circulate and has circulated in another couple of exhibitions, and which also, by the way, I consider to be kind of a multiple. I repeat it in different formats and so on, so it circulates the most and in most contexts. I feel that I have personally expressed what I have to say about it. In personal terms, I did move on, and the thing that made me move on was that I had a child. I have a son. And that's firstly the experience of pure love. You expect nothing in exchange. It's just pure love when you see your own son. You just love him, or your own girl, if I had a girl. You just love that being. And second, the undeniable biological fact that we do go on. Life does go on. We do go on. So the confirmation of that fact is, for me, there's no cure for a wound or for a trauma, but if something will had made me find closure, wasn't art, nor the success of that art, nor the public success of that art, but actually was having a child.
Well, Nicolas Guagnini, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
I do thank you for paying attention to all these issues and giving me the opportunity to connect with the audience.
Thank you. And Nicolas Guagnini will be speaking today at 6 o'clock at Site Santa Fe. And Juliet Myers is the Director of Education and Public Programs at Site Santa Fe. The number over there is 989-1199. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. We're going to hear from Ron Bloomberg at our beloved underwriters. And when we come back, we'll be talking about HIV vaccines. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. So here's what's going on with me. I think I've had my 15 minutes of fame. Well, maybe not exactly fame, but I've certainly had the microphone for a couple minutes each week to hopefully give you a little comedy relief. And now, after 3 years, I'm not sure I have anything more to say. So I'm going to disappear for a while. In all likelihood, this will be my last commentary for KSFR. Stop cheering out there. This is my one dramatic scene. If this were television, we'd zoom in for a close-up of a tear welling in my left eye. My right eye couldn't care less. I don't know what to do with that eye. It only wants to watch news clips of Dick Cheney. But where am I? Oh, yes, saying goodbye, which is tough, because so many of you have come up to me and told me how much you enjoy A Voice in the Crowd. All right, three of you have come up to me, and one of you asked me to hand over my wallet. But it's time to go. So I've asked a couple of friends to help me say so long. Sing it, Bob.
Thanks for the memory of sentimental verse. Nothing in my purse, and chuckles when the preacher said, for better or for worse.
How lovely it was. Thanks for the memory.
Thank you, guys. And thank you for listening. It has been fun. Talk to you down the line, if you have a minute.
I'd like now to welcome Dr. Betty Korber. She is a biologist laboratory fellow at Los Alamos National Laboratory and an external professor at the Santa Fe Institute. And she will be speaking on in the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers today from 6 to 8 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue here in Santa Fe. The talk is titled, Trying to Make a Vaccine Against a Moving Target, HIV and Its Diversity. Welcome.
Hi.
When we talk about HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, I thought it might be good to start off for our listeners just asking you, what is a virus?
What a virus is something that can't live independently, and so it has to infect a cell of another organism, and then it takes over that cell, and it uses that cell to reproduce itself, and that's how viruses survive and expand inside of a body.
Does it have its own DNA?
The virus that I study the most is HIV, and it's called a retrovirus because it uses RNA instead of DNA. So what it does is it binds to its target cell, and then it fuses with it, and it dumps its RNA into that cell, and it gets reverse copied. So that's why it's a retrovirus, because it goes backwards from RNA to DNA. And then the viral DNA gets put into the cellular DNA, so it gets integrated into our DNA. And it turns the cell that it's infected into a viral-producing factory, essentially. So it just starts dumping a lot of virus, or it can just sit and wait quietly and start expressing itself later. But it really becomes part of our DNA, and then it turns that cell into something that makes many more viruses.
So, how does the body's immune system normally deal with viruses?
It has a couple of different mechanisms, and so there's something called innate immunity, and that just means it's got, there are certain triggers that when we get an infection, either a bacteria or a virus, that stimulate immune responses that are just sort of general. But we also have something called immune memory, and we make very specific viruses for something we've seen before. So if you've had...
We make specific viruses?
We make specific immune responses to a virus we've seen before. So, for example, if you had influenza this year, you might make a very good immune response to it. And then you'd save some of those cells. And so the next time you got infected, you'd have immune memory.
And are those what we call antibodies?
The cells make the antibodies. So the cells that are stimulated by seeing something foreign that isn't us make antibodies, and that's part of the immune system. Or there's also these things called killer T cells. And those recognize a cell that's been infected by a virus, and they can cause that cell to explode and get rid of it, which you want to do because once the cell's been infected, it just turns into this thing that makes more viruses, so you want to get rid of those.
So T cells actually cause infected cells to blow up?
They do, yeah. It's like a war zone.
Really?
Yeah, and it's happening all the time in us. And so we have actually a couple of different kinds of T cells, but cytotoxic or killer T cells are the ones that will recognize a virally infected cell because it's not us. It has viral proteins on its surface, and it'll say, ah, this guy's foreign. Got to kill it. So then it will send out signals that cause the cell to virtually explode and stop making viruses.
When you think about the human immune deficiency, human immune system, do you ever think about the metaphor of that as it relates to human society?
I think about it some, but not too much. I usually think about it as the immune system.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing to think about, though, because it really is able to differentiate us from, you know, millions of different pathogens and things that aren't us that we need to be able to eliminate and keep out of our bodies. And it is able to recognize those things and get rid of them usually. There's another part of the immune system called helper T cells, and those are the cells that wake up when they see something foreign and something that isn't us. And they send out all sorts of signals to trigger the cells that make antibodies or to trigger these killer T cells to go on the attack and take out the thing that's invaded our system.
So T cells, of course, are something that is often talked about when you talk about HIV because the virus HIV attacks the T cells. Is that correct, or it makes them work so hard that, I mean, what happens?
It does attack the T cells. So viruses usually have one kind of cell that they're able to recognize and get into. They have a protein on their surface that is a receptor that binds to that cell and then it is able to get into that cell. And it just so happens that the cell that the HIV virus is able to infect is an immune cell, and it's those helper T cells. It's kind of the cell that conducts the rest of the immune response.
Which is why HIV is so dangerous.
Right, and why it hurts your immune system. And so what you what happens when you get HIV is you get a lot of these helper T cells infected, and they're the things that have to orchestrate the rest of the immune response. And so you do okay for a while, and you're able to mount good immune responses for some years after you've been infected, but meanwhile the virus is sort of wearing away at your immune system, and it's getting less and less effective. So if you die of AIDS, you eventually die of opportunistic infections, they're called. They're the other kinds of infections that get into your body that your body can't fight anymore because HIV is so damaged to your immune system.
So your talk is titled Trying to Make a Vaccine Against the Moving Target, HIV and Its Diversity. What do you mean by diversity?
What I mean by that is that HIV evolves really rapidly. And so if you were to take the virus out of two different people that were infected, they would have quite different viruses. It mutates really quickly. And part of why that happens is because you're infected for a long time. You never really clear the virus after you've been infected. So you may be infected for 8 or 10 years, and you're making immune responses against HIV, and HIV is escaping those immune responses in your body all the time. So it gets...
Because it's mutating so much.
Yes, and right. And because you've got these antibodies or T cells that are killing the virus, so the virus tries to become something different, slightly different, so it's able to evade those immune responses. So it's continuously evolving in each person a little bit, and every person sort of has a different immune response, so it evolves in different ways in different people. And so if you were to line up the DNA... from the viruses from different individuals, they would maybe be 10 or 12% different. In one country, maybe up to 35% different if you were to look at it globally.
We're talking to Dr. Betty Korber, who will be tonight speaking at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex in the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers, trying to make a vaccine against a moving target. So that makes it really hard to make a vaccine for a virus that doesn't mutate so quickly. How do you make a vaccine?
Well, usually the way people have made vaccines in the past is they'll get the virus out, and they'll either do something called attenuating it, which is making it so weak that it no longer makes you sick, and then you can give that, and you make an immune response to that, and you have that beautiful immune memory. So once you've seen something, when you see it again, you can respond very fast and very effectively. So they'll do that, or they might take a single protein out of a virus and just put that little part of it into something called a vector, which is something that carries that protein in the vaccine. So it's a safe thing that doesn't hurt you, but it has either a bit of the virus or an attenuated virus, and you make a good immune response to that. You have all the memory cells, so then when you see the real thing, you become infected, your immune system can respond very quickly and very potently. And so if the virus isn't variable, you just use one of them, and you make an immune response, and then it's able to cross-recognize other of its kind. Whereas with HIV, because it's so variable, that can really be an obstacle.
And it certainly is, and I want to get back to that in a second. But let's talk for a moment about the treat. There's no vaccine at this point for HIV, but there are treatments. How do those treatments work, the so-called cocktail that people drink?
Well, they actually don't.
They take.
The cocktail, it's called a cocktail because it's actually a few things mixed
right.
up. So you have to take more than one drug at a time, and that's because HIV evolves so fast, actually. If you just take one drug, the virus will mutate away from that drug very quickly, and you'll become resistant to that drug. But if you take three drugs or four drugs, the virus can't mutate against all of those at once, and so you're able to hold the virus in check and able to live a much longer, healthier life. What those do is they are very specific to parts of the virus that the virus needs to function. Like, remember I said HIV is an RNA virus, and it has to take that RNA and go to DNA before it can become a provirus and part of our cellular DNA. So that step, RNA to DNA, requires an enzyme that the virus carries with it called reverse transcriptase. And so you could, say, have a drug that binds to the part of the virus that turns RNA to DNA, and it blocks that from happening.
Uh-huh.
So you could have something like that, or the virus has proteins that have to be chopped up into smaller proteins using something called a protease. So you could have a drug that binds to the protease and inhibits its ability to chop up those proteins, and then HIV can't be functional. So that's what those drugs do, and it took us actually a long time to get to those, too. It wasn't really until 1996, 1997 that we had effective drugs for HIV, but it was discovered in 1981, so it took a while to get there.
Do those drugs work for virtually everybody who takes them?
Sometimes they have side effects that are hard for some people and not so hard for other people, so some people don't tolerate them very well. And some people develop drug resistance. So say you're given these three drugs, but you just want to not take them for a few weeks or a few months. You can develop drug resistance if you do that. Or if you don't take them very regularly, you don't take them every day, you can develop drug resistance.
So you actually have to take them every day in order for them to work?
You really do. You need to take them every day. Otherwise, your virus is going to maybe be able to evolve away from them being effective. And you become a carrier of drug-resistant virus. And some people are now carrying drug-resistant virus and can even transmit that to other people. So you can check for those mutations in the viral DNA, and you can say, oh, this person has the mutation that's going to make this drug not effective, so we're going to try to give them a different one. So the doctors try to, you know, figure that out. But people can develop drug resistance, and it can be really a problem trying to get the right drug combination to help them survive.
So in terms of this very diverse, quickly mutating HIV virus, where does science stand? Where do you stand in the quest for making a virus, a vaccine?
Well, I think a vaccine's incredibly important. So the therapy is wonderful, and it's really helped a lot of people, you know, live good long lives and feel much better for the life that they have. But they're very expensive. It's not just one drug. It's three drugs. It's for your life. It's a lifetime that you have to do it because you don't clear the virus. The virus wakes up in you if you stop taking the drugs. So the world can't afford this, and there's 40 million people infected with HIV right now. There's very poor nations that have, you know, 25% of their population infected, and these people can't afford
it. Places in Africa, for example.
Yes, yeah. So Botswana and South Africa have really very high infection rates. And they're
the least able to afford the drugs.
Right. And in China, for example, once you have AIDS, you're given drugs, but you can't have drugs until you get AIDS. And maybe they could prolong your life before you have AIDS if you didn't have to wait until that moment.
If you knew you were HIV positive.
Yeah, because they're so expensive. So the expense of the drugs really make it a problem. In fact, it's a lifetime commitment, the fact that you evolve resistance. And the thing about a vaccine is if we can finally figure out how to develop an effective vaccine, you give the vaccine maybe a couple shots and the person's protected for life, doesn't ever have to get HIV. It's a much better way to reach out to people who are in the developing world and give them something that can keep them from getting HIV in the first place. So, or if they do, HIV is kind of different than typically vaccines. Prevent you from getting infected. And with HIV, we may never be able to achieve that, but we might be able to achieve something where you mount such a good immune response when you first see the virus that you're able to control it yourself without having to take drugs, and maybe you're also less infectious. So that's a possible goal for an HIV vaccine that, if realized, would also be a great help.
But there are roadblocks on the way to getting a vaccine.
Right. HIV was first discovered as a virus in 1983, and it's 2007, and a lot of smart people have been thinking about this, and we don't have one yet. So, in fact, there was a recent trial that just ended from the company Merck that was people were really hopeful about, and it didn't turn out to be protective, and they stopped the trial. So it's a really challenging problem, and the diversity of HIV, I think, is maybe one of the greatest challenges, if not the greatest challenge for making an effective vaccine.
When Merck did these trials and a vaccine was tested, how do they? I mean, you can't obviously experiment on human beings. How did they get their results?
Well, it takes a lot of years to get a vaccine into trial. So what you do is you come up with a concept, and then you test that to see if it's sort of reasonable in vitro, which would maybe be in the cell culture or experimentally in terms of seeing if antibodies bind to your vaccine or that kind of thing. And if that all passes, you put it into small animals. So you would maybe put it into guinea pigs or mice or something like that.
Do guinea pigs and mice get HIV? They get
AIDS? They don't. So they're not a good model for protection. But you can see if your vaccine doesn't hurt them and is safe. And you can see if your vaccine is able to elicit a very good immune response, is able to interact with a lot of different HIV viruses that you have growing in the laboratory. So you can't infect those animals, but you can check to see if they're making good, effective immune responses. And if it passes that test, now we're a couple years down the road, you put it into macaques, which are kind of monkey. That's the best animal model for HIV, and it's very expensive to do those tests. But you try your concept in macaques. And
these are monkeys that do get HIV?
They get a cousin of HIV. So they get a simian virus that's like HIV, and they can get sick from it.
Uh-huh.
So you can test those animals to see if they get protected from infection or if they get protection from disease with your vaccine. But it's not a perfect model. It's got quite a few flaws. But nonetheless, it's the best. It's the only real model that we have that's not human. And you can also just see if the macaques make a good immune response and if they're making effective T cells and if they're making good antibodies. And they're, because they're primates and so are we, they're more like us, and so we're more likely to respond like they respond. So if all of that's a go and everything is looking like it's making sense and working well, you move into a very small human trial and you make sure it's safe and you make sure that people are making some immune response. So that would maybe be on the order of 30 people, something like that. That's called a phase one trial. And if that goes well, and nobody is getting sick or having problems with the vaccine, everybody seems safe, and they seem to be making good immune responses, you can start scaling up. And so Merck was in that scale-up phase. Everything had gone well so far, and there is some reason to believe that this might be helpful in people, but the only way to really know is to test it in people. So you have to go through all this preliminary stuff first.
And so what happened?
Well, what happened was it wasn't protective. So they gave the vaccine to quite a few people. They had this was in like the U.S. and the Caribbean. They were going to move the vaccine into African trials. And then they have midpoint checks to see, is the vaccine working? Is it helpful? Is it not helpful? And they did a midpoint check, and it just wasn't helpful, and so they stopped the trial.
I would think that there would be a ethical problem, which is that if people know they're being tested for an HIV a vaccine, they might be more likely to have unprotected sex.
That's a real ethical issue, and people get intensely counseled who get enrolled in these vaccine programs. And, you know, you tell these people that you don't know that this is going to work. They might get placebo, so they might not even get the vaccine. But they're also really in an experimental system. They don't know that it's going to work, and they try to teach people about that. They also try to teach them about things like safe sex. So they're trying to reduce their risk, and that's all part of being enrolled in a vaccine trial. It's complex.
Well, unfortunately, it's time to go now, but I want to thank you, and much more to talk about. Betty Korber will be speaking tonight in the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers from 6 to 8 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. And she is a biologist laboratory fellow at Los Alamos National Laboratory and an external professor at the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.